Go ahead.
So the histones and the DNA, it's attracted to each other because of the phosphate group.
Yeah.
So is the head of the histone positive? And that's why it winds around that fold?
I think it's the head, yes. Yeah, it would have to be. Yes, definitely. I just don't have a structural formula in mind. I'm used to this just cartoon version. Okay, now to the final chapter and of the unit. And this has to do with the other major function of DNA. In the previous chapter, we talked about one of DNA's major functions, which is replication. Now we're going to talk about the other major function, which is transcription, but the chapter is about more than just transcription. Transcription is just the part, just part of what we call gene expression. Gene expression includes transcription, but also more than that. Transcription, though, is the only part of gene expression that the genes themselves, which are the DNA, is directly involved in. Okay? We'll get to gene expression in a minute, but let me just quickly introduce this experiment summarized in slide one. And I'm going to skip really talking about why they designed it this way. That information is on the synchronized slideshows, but I'm going to run out of time if I try to get bogged down in the details. Let me just tell you that the researchers here were trying to test their hypothesis, which they called the one gene, one enzyme hypothesis. So this is back in the days when we already, by the experiments we talked about, have pinned down DNA as the genetic material, but we didn't know how it operated. So genes are DNA, and the question is, how do genes work back in these days? And so they put forth the one gene, one enzyme hypothesis, which means that a gene corresponds to an enzyme. In other words, a gene tells a cell how to make a particular enzyme. And like I said, I'm not going to really talk about the experimental details, but it partially confirmed their hypothesis, meaning there is a correspondence between some genes and some enzymes, or of enzymes in general, but one gene, one enzyme hypothesis is actually partially wrong. And that's because it's not true that every gene corresponds to an enzyme. All enzymes correspond to genes, but not all genes correspond to enzymes. And so they later modified the hypothesis into the one gene, one protein hypothesis. Now, you know already that all enzymes are proteins, but not all proteins are enzymes. So that's the problem with one gene, one enzyme. Some genes correspond to proteins that are not enzymes. Well, so that's an improvement, saying one gene, one protein, but that's still wrong, because not all genes even correspond to proteins at all. And this brings up two different categories of genes. The vast majority of genes are protein-coding genes. And that's because when they get transcribed, when the information stored in the gene gets used, it's used to make a messenger RNA molecule. And then DNA's job is done at that moment, but now messenger RNA is holding the instructions for how to build a protein. That's the second part of gene expression, translation, and so the protein gets built. Those are protein-coding genes. Most genes do that. But there are other genes called non-protein-coding genes, and they also get transcribed, but when they get transcribed, the product is not messenger RNA. Instead, it's any of the various other kinds of RNA. Messenger RNA is just one of many kinds of RNA. No cell has any idea how to make any kind of RNA. It has to be told how to. That's what genes are for. Genes tell cells how to build RNA. So non-protein coding genes are there to tell the cell how to build all the kinds of RNA other than mRNA. And the protein coding genes are there to tell them specifically how to build mRNA, which then goes on to a second process called translation to actually build a protein. So this is why even one gene, one protein is wrong. And they even modified it again into one gene, one polypeptide, which is still wrong for a couple reasons, actually. Well, one is the problem I just told you. Not all genes even correspond to polypeptides. The reason it's better than one protein is that, remember, there are these multimeric proteins that are made up of multiple polypeptides, like hemoglobin. It actually takes multiple genes, one for each different kind of polypeptide in a multimeric protein, to code for the overall protein. So that's why one polypeptide was an improvement, but it's still wrong because there are non-protein coding genes. Another reason, though, that it's wrong is that in eukaryotes, it's even possible for one gene to code for multiple different polypeptides. And I'll tell you how later. But that's why that one gene, one polypeptide, which is the most refined of those three hypotheses, is still not technically correct. Well, they eventually stopped naming it, but the importance historically is that they showed a connection between a gene and a protein. And that's really what gene expression is about. When I say gene expression, I don't bother to say protein gene expression, protein coding gene expression, because most genes are protein coding genes, and we usually just don't bother saying protein coding genes. Unless I say non-protein coding gene, when I say just gene, I'm talking about a protein coding gene. And that goes for gene expression. So let's look at gene expression in slide 2 as an overall process. It's a two-part process. Gene expression consists of transcription and translation in that order. Transcription happens first. Translation then happens. And DNA is involved in only the first of the processes. The gene is made of DNA, so the gene is involved only in transcription. Now, there are two figures shown here because the way this happens is slightly different in the two cells, the two types of cells in the dichotomy of cell types. So you have a prokaryotic cell above, bacterium as an example, and a eukaryotic cell like one of ours below. A lot of the process is the same, but think about the fundamental difference structurally between a prokaryotic cell and a eukaryotic cell. By definition, a prokaryotic cell does not have a nucleus, and it therefore, or any other membrane-bounded organelles, and therefore a prokaryotic cell has one compartment. It is not subcompartmentalized. That means that it's a simpler process. Gene expression is in a sense, a simpler process in a prokaryotic cell because transcription and translation can happen in the same compartment, the only compartment that's there. Transcription, regardless of cell type, has to happen where the DNA is because it involves the DNA. But in a prokaryotic cell, where the DNA is where the entire cell contents is. So transcription occurs in the cytoplasm, because that's where the DNA is, and translation occurs also in the cytoplasm. It's a more direct process. But transcription produces, by reading the DNA in the gene, transcription produces a messenger RNA molecule represented by the red ribbon here. Okay, that's the product of transcription. Transcription is done, DNA's job is done, and then the messenger RNA is now carrying information that it got from DNA. The information is in that messenger RNA's own sequence, and that messenger RNA will meet up with a ribosome, which is a specialized organelle for translation. Translation itself refers to assembling the polypeptide one amino acid at a time. Just like cells have no idea how to build a messenger RNA or any other kind of RNA without being told how to, they also have no idea how to build a protein That's why the only proteins your body's ever going to be able to make are the ones that your genes, you have genes for. And that's why you can't digest cellulose, like I was saying before.
What about prions?
Well, they are, you mean what about creating them? They still have to be created to begin with. Okay. By translation, all proteins are. But in the case of prions, something about that protein structure allows them, if they get misformed, allows them to cause misformation in other copies of that same protein. And that's why it leads to things like mad cow disease and related disorders in humans. Prion diseases, it's pretty interesting that without any infectious agent, without any living pathogen, just the molecule itself causes other molecules to go bad, other molecules like it. But they still, I mean, that they still have, that the prions originally were built as normal proteins by translation, just like all other proteins, and then they go bad after that. All right, so everything happens in one chamber in a bacterium or any other prokaryote. But in a eukaryotic cell, there is compartmentalization. Once again, you have to have transcription occur where the DNA is, but that means transcription occurs in the nucleus in a eukaryotic cell, and that's where, therefore, the messenger RNA is produced. Well, translation, the assembly of the polypeptide, occurs where the ribosomes are, which is out in the cytoplasm. And that's an additional complication, therefore, because in order for translation to occur, you have to get the messenger RNA that was created in the nucleus out of that nucleus so that it can meet up with ribosomes. And that is why you have a nuclear envelope that is perforated by those nuclear pores. The nuclear pores allow messenger RNA to get out of the nucleus where they're created and into the cytoplasm where they get used. Now, you see another difference between the two cell types with respect to how gene expression happens, and that is that for a prokaryotic cell, the messenger RNA that gets produced in transcription is ready to go for translation. It doesn't have to be modified after transcription creates it. That's why no changes have been made to this red thing. But in a eukaryotic cell, the direct product of transcription, what comes off of the transcription assembly line, is called the pre-mRNA because even though it's mRNA, it's not yet in its completed form to be used. So pre-mRNA then gets modified, and this happens after transcription, so we call this post-transcriptional modification. And I'll tell you how it's modified later on. But once it's in its mature version, the modified version, then it gets out. By the way, one of these modifications is to put on these yellow ends so that it can get out. Of course, it needs to be able to get out to go up into the cytoplasm where translation takes place.
You said it was post-transcription mRNA?
Post-transcriptional modification of mRNA. Now to three. So we have just a tiny little piece of DNA, because a typical chromosome, which is one long DNA in your body, for instance, contains thousands of genes and many millions of individual nucleotides, most of which are not in genes. So these non-coding regions I was talking about before are the light blue regions between genes, although this is not drawn to scale. They would be much longer than the genes themselves because they add up to 99% of your overall DNA. Anyway, you have three genes being shown here. Each one is a set of instructions for how to make a particular mRNA, and each of those mRNAs is going to be a set of instructions for how to make a particular polypeptide, because we're talking about protein-coding genes here. But the little box here, the inset, is shown in close-up right here. So this dark blue double-stranded DNA is not even one whole gene. It's just a piece of one gene. That's why it fades out on the ends. Anyway, this shows you the difference between transcription and translation. And hopefully it will make sense to you linguistically now, because both of these words, notice, start with trans. It's easy to mix up which one is which. Think about what the words mean, though, in everyday life, not in biology. To transcribe, which is the verb form of transcription, means to rewrite, right? If you if you're transcribing what I say when you write notes, you're putting it down in a different form. Or if you can order a transcript of a meeting or a show, and it's a written account of what was said. So transcription is just rewriting, but it doesn't change the language, right? You're writing in the same language I'm speaking in. That's a good description of what happens molecularly here, though, because we're starting out with DNA, which is a code written in the language of nucleotides. And then we're going to rewrite that code still in the language of nucleotides, but RNA nucleotides. So it's kind of like a different dialect, but it's the same language. Okay? And that's why it's called transcription. It's just rewriting. It's not changing it into a different language. Translation, on the other hand, is a word that refers to a change in language, right? And that's what's being done in this second part when you think about the molecules. Because this red mRNA, which is called the mRNA transcript, it's the product of transcription, it is the code for how to build a polypeptide. So it tells the cell the specific sequence of amino acids to link together on the bottom here to make the polypeptide. Well, that's a change in language, because mRNA is written in the language of nucleotides, and a polypeptide is constructed or written in the language of amino acids. Totally different language. Okay? So think about it that way if you get confused about which process is which. Transcription has to happen first, then translation. There's another couple important things about this slide, though. DNA is double-stranded, of course, but in transcription, unlike replication, let me just start that over. Replication, as we just learned, uses both strands, right? You have to use both strands, each separately as a template in DNA replication. But in transcription, you don't use or read both strands. You're reading one or the other. And so for any given gene, it's only one of the two strands that gets read. The other one, they have to be separated from each other, like I've talked about. But after separation, you just ignore one and you read the other. And which one you read and which one you ignore depends. It's just on a gene-by-gene basis. So in this particular example, which is gene 1 here in the uppercase, it's this top strand that is the one that gets read. And whichever one gets read is called the template strand. The non-template strand is going to be removed from it temporarily and then just ignored. But as you go down the line and you hit the next gene, it might be this bottom strand in the next gene that is the template strand. It just depends on the gene. Okay, now the template strand, this is a little bit confusing, because the template strand, of course, in the DNA is, because of the rules of complementarity, exactly complementary to the non-template strand. Right? Well, when you build a messenger RNA, you do it similarly to how you build DNA in replication, except you're using RNA instead of DNA. But what I mean, what is similar about it is that you use complementarity to build it. So even though the template strand is the one that you read, when you go through complementarity rules, that means the mRNA that you build ends up being just like the non-template strand, except it won't have any thymine, it'll have uracil instead of the T's. So don't be confused by this. The messenger RNA ends up looking almost identical to the non-coding, the non-template strand, but not because we use the non-template strand. It's just because of rules of complementarity. Does that make sense? So this template strand is being read, and you can ignore this bottom strand, and you just see ACCA, just by complementarity rules, that means this would be a T, but you have to use a U instead, because it's RNA. The C calls for a G, the C calls for a G, the A calls for a U, and so on. That's the messenger RNA. Okay, since this is the same language, namely nucleotides that we're operating in, transcription features a one-to-one correspondence. What I mean by that is every individual DNA nucleotide in the DNA corresponds to one RNA nucleotide in the messenger RNA. Okay? So they both use four. They're not the same four, as we've said, T in DNA instead of U in RNA. But in both RNA and DNA, there's four choices. That's why there can be a one-to-one correspondence. And a one-to-one correspondence is nice and simple. Unfortunately, you can't have a one-to-one correspondence when it comes to translation. What I mean is that you can't have the situation of having one RNA nucleotide in the messenger RNA correspond to one amino acid in the polypeptide. It would be nice if you could. But why is that impossible?
There's more proteins than the four bases.
Not more proteins. More
amino acids.
Right. Yeah. Right. mRNA uses four different kinds of nucleotides, right? A, U, C, and G. But organisms use 20 different amino acids to build their proteins out of. So you can't have a one-to-one correspondence. If you tried to do that, you could have each of the different nucleotides correspond to a different amino acid, but then you'd be done after you specified four different amino acids, right? There are 16 more amino acids that you need to specify. So you can't specify 20 amino acids with four nucleotides using a one-to-one basis. If you could, that would have happened because it's the simplest, and evolution favors the simplest. Well, I'm getting there. Let's think about this problem, though. Since you can't do a one-to-one correspondence, the next simplest possibility would be to, instead of using just one nucleotide to specify amino acid, you would specify a sequence of, sequence of two RNA nucleotides to specify a single amino acid. Well, there are four kinds, so how many possible two nucleotide sequences are there? Where each place is one of four possibilities. How do you mathematically figure that out? 16, right. It's 4 times 4. For each of the 4 possibilities in the first slot, you have 4 possibilities in the second. So it's 4 times 4. Well, 4 times 4 is still only 16, less than 20, right? So that won't work either. And that's why it didn't happen. And that's why the simplest possible solution to this correspondence is to use a sequence of three RNA nucleotides to specify a single amino acid. Okay? And that's exactly how all organisms do it. You have here the word codon. Strictly speaking, a codon refers to a triplet, which is a sequence of three nucleotides, in the messenger RNA molecule. But that messenger RNA comes from the information that was originally in the DNA. So sometimes we use the word codon to refer to the corresponding triplet in the gene itself, in the DNA. But strictly speaking, a codon is part of the messenger RNA, not part of the DNA. All right? Is that a question? Yeah.
It's chromosome 3.
Yes. And that's because it's the simplest solution, right? But how many three nucleotide sequences are there? How do you figure it out? If there's four possibilities for each of the three... Right, four cubed, which is what?
64.
So there's 64 codons, which is way more than you need, right? But you can't use a sequence of two because 16 is less than 20. 64 is more, though, so it's plenty. And that's, you know, there's no need to use anything more complicated to that because 64 is already more than you need. Okay, so one codon, which is a triplet in messenger RNA, corresponds to a single amino acid in the polypeptide. And you see the amino acids being linked together here on the bottom. Now, that's the overall length of the polypeptide, how many amino acids it's made out of, depends. It varies drastically from dozens in a simple protein to thousands in a complex polypeptide. Okay, now to four. Go ahead.
Combinations, do some of them code for the same amino acid, or some of them...
That's good thinking, and this is exactly where we're heading on this slide. Slide 4 shows you the genetic code. And I really should pronounce that as the genetic code, because this is not the genetic code for any one species. This is not the human genetic code, and giraffes use something else, and palm trees use something else. This is the genetic code that all organisms use. And that fact, by the way, is one of the strongest bits of evidence we have indicating that all organisms came from the originally successful lineage of cells. We're all related if you go back to that trunk of the tree of life. We all do it the same way. The genetic code, though, is really just an exhaustive listing of all the possible codons, which we just said there's 64 of. So there's 64 entries in the genetic code. Most of them, notice, in this figure, have lavender background color. Not all of them, though. 60 of them are these lavender-colored ones. And for each codon, which are the triplets of all caps, those are messenger RNA nucleotides, UUG, for instance, is one codon. Each codon, though, corresponds to a three-letter that's not all caps, three-letter symbol for one of the 20 amino acids. So phenylalanine, leucine, and so on. You don't have to memorize all 20 amino acids, but that's what those stand for. Okay? Now, there are four special codons, the ones that are not lavender. Three of these are orange in this figure, and notice that those are labeled as stop codons. They all function identically to each other, all three stop codons, so it doesn't matter which one is used, but only one of them will be used for each messenger RNA. A stop codon, as its name implies, comes at the end and tells the ribosome, which is the little machine that's assembling the polypeptide, it tells it to stop. In other words, it tells it, you just got done adding the last amino acid, the polypeptide is done, stop the process of translation. Okay, they all, either any one of these three will do that equally well. But notice that none of the three stop codons corresponds to an amino acid. So that's all it does is tell it to stop. The previous codon, before you get to that stop codon, tells the ribosome which is the last amino acid. Okay? Then you give the green one. There's only one of these, which is AUG. This does double duty. AUG, notice, corresponds to MET, which is short for methionine. That's one of the 20 amino acids, 20 biological amino acids. So AUG always specifies methionine. And it can occur as many times as in a messenger RNA as you want. Every time it comes up, though, methionine gets added to this growing strand of polypeptide, amino acids to make up the polypeptide. The double duty comes in the fact that it also serves as the start codon for all messenger RNAs, which means we'll get into the particulars of translation in a little bit, but the ribosome starts reading the messenger RNA at the first AUG it finds. That tells it this is where we start reading codons one at a time. And since it also codes for methionine, that means all polypeptides, whether they want to or not, start with methionine as the first amino acid in the sequence. Okay, now there are a couple really important properties of the genetic code that I need to talk about briefly. One of these is that the genetic code is redundant, and the other is that the genetic code is not ambiguous. So it is redundant, it's not ambiguous. Let's carefully think about what these words mean. What does redundant mean? It can be, but not necessarily. Redundant means repetitive. Like, I hear people all the time saying, so-and-so is very unique. Well, there aren't degrees of uniqueness. Unique means there are only one of you, right? So you really can't be very unique. But that's just an example. Redundant means saying the same thing over and over. All right? The reason the genetic code is redundant is because 64 is greater than 20, and this is what you were noticing. Since you have 64, well, really 61 amino acid specifying codons, in other words, not the stop codons, you have 61 to work with, but you only have to specify 20 amino acids. That means it's possible for more than one codon to specify the same amino acid, and you see that right here. Serine, for instance, in the second column, that's specified by any one of these four codons. So that's the redundancy. It's exactly analogous to synonyms in language. And English is famous for this because English is really just a bunch of languages combined. So English by far has more words in it than any other language because it imported all these different words for the same meaning from different languages. And that's why we have all kinds of different ways to say that it's the same thing. You know, if something is big, yes, you can use the word big, but there's a lot of other words you can use that also mean big. Synonyms are redundant if you use them that way. All right, so that's redundancy, and the genetic code is redundant. But I also said that it is not ambiguous. So what does it mean to be ambiguous in everyday language? No, it's the opposite of that, actually. Ambi, like in amphibian that I was talking about, ambi is not the same root, but it's similar. It has the same meaning. Ambiguous means being unclear because there are multiple possible meanings. Okay? And I usually use the same example here, a really simple phrase. Just a two-word sentence. I'm hot is an ambiguous statement. Because hot is an ambiguous word, right? So if I say that, you don't know whether I'm saying it because my body temperature is elevated. That's one meaning. It could be that I am currently very, very, very famous individual, right? Hot at the moment. Could mean that I'm really angry. Could mean that I'm sexually attractive. And maybe others as well. But that's four distinct meanings relayed by the same word. And that's why it is unclear unless you can tell by context what I'm talking about. Well, ambiguity is sometimes problematic in language, but we can deal with it various ways. In the genetic code, ambiguity would be disastrous, though. What it would mean, if the genetic code were ambiguous, and I just told you it's not, that would mean that a codon specifies a certain amino acid sometimes, and in other conditions it would specify a different amino acid. That would be disastrous because when you use the code in translation to build the polypeptide, you would be building different polypeptides depending on how you interpret the codes. And remember we talked about the primary sequence and how that affects the secondary, the primary structure, and how that affects secondary, tertiary structure, and that determines the shape of a protein. Well, if you don't get that sequence the same, it's not going to have the overall shape the same, and therefore it's not going to function the same. Proteins, regardless of what they do, function the way they do because of their specific shape. So sequence is really important. Yeah. Not the gene, because this is part of RNA. You can tell where the gene begins and ends, though, in relation to the mRNA. You know, if you match up the mRNA to the DNA that codes for it, the coding part of it starts where you get the AUG. And it goes all the way until you hit the first stop codon.
Or not the opposite.
From the template strand. Yeah, that would be the corresponding region in the DNA, but the mRNA is what actually has the codons, and it is actually longer than that. So it's important to be able to tell where the AUG is. Not the AUG isn't at the very beginning. It's just the beginning of where it's going to start reading. And we'll talk more about that when I get to another picture. Now to five. Here we see photographs of two different organisms that are a little bit unusual. A tobacco plant that is glowing and a pig that is glowing. Neither one of those organisms are really naturally glowing, right? But this is not photoshopped. These are real photographs. These organisms actually are glowing. They're emitting light. And that's because they are genetically modified organisms that into which a gene from a different organism that does glow naturally has been put into their bodies. I shouldn't say put into their bodies. The way it works is that the gene is inserted into one cell, and then that one cell, now that it's genetically modified, undergoes natural replication, and each of the two cells that it produces now already has that new gene, and therefore when it grows up, the whole body has... Every cell in the body has the modified gene. So the tobacco plant got its gene from a firefly, which naturally glows, and the pig got it from a jellyfish that glows. So they're different genes, but they work similarly. Anyway, the question here is, how is it that a gene that is from a firefly and works correctly in a firefly, how does it also work correctly in a distantly related organism like a tobacco plant? Same for the pig. That's right. It's because this genetic code is universal, as I said. Or I didn't say the word universal, but it's the genetic code for all organisms, and therefore genes can operate. They stand for the same sequence of polypeptides no matter what the organism is.
So you can just identify a genetic gene and input it to.
That's right, and that's exactly what genetically modified foods start out as. We intentionally insert one gene, for instance, to give the cells resistance to anything, including pathogens. You know, this is why genetically modified crops don't need to be sprayed with insecticides if they are given the gene that will give them resistance to the insects to begin with. Go ahead. There are reasons to be concerned with genetically modified organisms, but it's because of ecology. It's because of the possible effects ecologically in their interaction with other organisms. But it's in terms of the protein that gets produced, it's, yes, the gene is not naturally part of that organism, but when you make the protein, it's indistinguishable from the protein that you would have gotten from the natural organism that has that gene. In other words, the protein that we take in as food, it's just like eating it from the original organism. You're just eating it from a different organism that's producing it instead. It's not an unnatural chemical. It is a protein, biological protein, that's produced by a set of instructions called a gene. And by the way, we don't take proteins into our body anyway. They're much too huge. We digest them outside of our body while they're in our digestive tract and then absorb the amino acids. And the amino acids, you can't tell what kind of protein that came from, which is why it doesn't, as long as you're getting the right kinds of amino acids, all 20 of them, it doesn't matter whether the protein came from a plant, an animal, whatever. It's indistinguishable. They're all the same amino acids. Okay, anyway, let's go to 6. Now let's look at the molecular details of transcription, which is, in a sense, part one of gene expression. And what you see here is that the overall process of transcription is broken down into three major subphases, which are initiation, elongation, and termination, as you see. Initiation is just another name for starting. Elongation is self-explanatory. That's when you add more nucleotides, and termination means you're stopping. But if you look at this top DNA here at the top of the figure, that's a double-stranded DNA, of course, but like I was saying before, only one of those two strands is the template strand. What we're looking at here in dark blue, this is kind of an exception to what we've been using color-wise. Before, dark blue meant original material and light blue meant new material. Well, here, dark blue just shows you that this part of the DNA is this gene. The rest of it is not this gene. Okay? I wish they'd use different colors. But anyway, what's labeled here as a transcription unit is a gene. And initiation, getting the transcription going, in other words, requires the help of a special enzyme, which in this cartoon is this egg-shaped gray thing, called RNA polymerase. Now, it's called polymerase for the same reason that DNA polymerase that we've already studied is called that. In other words, it facilitates polymerization, which is the building of a polymer. But DNA polymerase polymerizes DNA. It builds a DNA polynucleotide, whereas RNA polymerase is going to build an RNA polynucleotide, which we call the mRNA transcript, the product of transcription. But anyway, to get this started, as we've talked about already several times, you have to read the code that's in the gene, and specifically in the template strand of the gene. And to do that, of course, you have to separate the two strands from each other. Where that separation of the two strands happens is at the very beginning of the gene. Now, when you look at DNA, it's all just A's, C's, T's, and G's in a sequence that's millions of nucleotides long. You can't just look at those. If they were all printed as A's, T's, C's, and G's, you can't say, oh, here's the beginning of the gene. It's all just nucleotides. But there is a specific sequence in each gene that the RNA polymerase is able to recognize as the beginning of the gene. And that little sequence is called the promoter. It's the seafoam green region of this in this cartoon. So the promoter is really the beginning of the gene, and that's what RNA polymerase recognizes, and then it has to bind to that promoter in order to separate the two strands. All right, that's what initiation is. So nothing is built in initiation, it's just recognizing the beginning of the gene and separating the strands. Okay, next is elongation, which of course does grow the strand. I want you to think back to the previous chapter, though, DNA replication, because remember we had that special problem of not being able to lay down DNA onto nothing. You can't start with DNA, which is why you had to start with an RNA primer. That was a problem for DNA replication, but it's not a problem for transcription, because the thing you're trying to build in transcription is RNA, not DNA. So we don't even call it a primer. You can just start building the mRNA transcript right from the start, because it's supposed to be RNA. But you do it the same way, based on complementarity rules, when you're reading the template strand. In this case, notice that the template strand is the bottom one of the two. Like I said, it just depends on the gene. And so the RNA polymerase enzyme is able to go in there once the strands are separated and read the template strand, use complementarity rules, and lay down the complementary RNA nucleotides one at a time to form this growing transcript. That's elongation. It will do that until it gets to the end of the gene, basically, which happens a little bit differently. We don't have to get into the details of how it recognizes the end, but eventually the RNA polymerase enzyme, the egg thing here, will dissociate from the DNA, and the RNA is at that point complete as far as transcription is concerned. Now, if this is happening in a eukaryotic cell, yes, transcription is done, but as I told you before, this mRNA is not yet ready to be used for translation. In a prokaryotic cell, it's not going to be modified. So transcription transcription makes the final version of messenger RNA in a prokaryote. But in any case, whether it's prokaryotic or eukaryotic, what comes off of this transcription assembly line is called the messenger RNA transcript. And I have to stop there. Go ahead. Rough endoplasmic reticulum does modification of polypeptides, but we haven't gotten there yet. We're still in mRNA form. There is no polypeptide that's been built yet. It's built in translation, the next part of gene expression. Go ahead.
Is there anything that follows the polymerase to zip it back up, or does it just close up because the RNA is out of the way?
Exactly, because the polymerase is out of the way. And the RNA, I see what you mean. Yes. In other words, since it's not using any single-strand binding protein to intentionally keep it apart, it does exactly what would happen if you didn't have single-strand binding protein in DNA replication. In other words, it's still the two strands are complementary to each other, so if they're still next to each other, they're going to seal right back together.